Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince by J.K. Rowling. Chapter 1. The Other Minister. It was nearing midnight, and the Prime Minister was sitting alone in his office, reading a long memo that was slipping through his brain without leaving the slightest trace of meaning behind. He was waiting for a call from the president of a far distant country, and between wondering when the wretched man would telephone and trying to suppress unpleasant memories of what had been a very long, tiring and difficult week, there was not much space in his head for anything else. The more he attempted to focus on the print on the page before him, the more clearly the Prime Minister could see the gloating face of one of his political opponents. This particular opponent had appeared on the news that very day, not only to enumerate all the terrible things that had happened in the last week, as though anyone needed reminding, but also to explain why each and every one of them was the government's fault. The Prime Minister's pulse quickened at the very thought of these accusations, for they were neither fair nor true. How on earth was his government supposed to have stopped that bridge collapsing? It was outrageous for anybody to suggest that they were not spending enough on bridges. The bridge was less than 10 years old, and the best experts were at a loss to explain why it had snapped cleanly in two, sending a dozen cars into the watery depths of the river below. And how dared anyone suggest that it was lack of policemen that had resulted in those two very nasty and well-publicized murders? Or that the government should have somehow foreseen the freak hurricane in the West Country that had caused so much damage to both people and property. And was it his fault that one of his junior ministers, Herbert Chorley, had chosen this week to act so peculiarly that he was now going to be spending a lot more time with his family? "A grim mood has gripped the country," the opponent had concluded, barely concealing his own broad grin. And unfortunately, this was perfectly true. The Prime Minister felt it himself. People really did seem more miserable than usual. Even the weather was dismal. All this chilly mist in the middle of July, it wasn't right, it wasn't normal. He turned over the second page of the memo, saw how much longer it went on, and gave it up as a bad job. Stretching his arms above his head, he looked around his office mournfully. It was a handsome room, with a fine marble fireplace facing the long sash windows firmly closed against the unseasonable chill. With a slight shiver, the Prime Minister got up and moved over to the windows, looking out at the thin mist that was pressing itself against the glass. It was then, as he stood with his back to the room, that he heard a soft cough behind him. He froze, nose to nose with his own scared-looking reflection in the dark glass. He knew that cough. He had heard it before. He turned very slowly to face the empty room. "Hello?" he said, trying to sound braver than he felt. For a brief moment he allowed himself the impossible hope that nobody would answer him. However, a voice responded at once, a crisp, decisive voice that sounded as though it were reading a prepared statement. It was coming, as the Prime Minister had known at the first cough, from the frog-like little man wearing a long silver wig who was depicted in a small and dirty oil painting in the far corner of the room.
"To the Prime Minister of Muggles, urgent we meet. Kindly respond immediately. Sincerely, Fudge."
The man in the painting looked inquiringly at the Prime Minister.
Said the Prime Minister. Listen, it's not a very good time for me. I'm waiting for a telephone call, you see, from the President of...
That can be rearranged, said the portrait at once.
The Prime Minister's heart sank. He had been afraid of that.
But I was really rather hoping to speak.
We shall arrange for the President to forget to call. He will telephone tomorrow night instead, said the little man. Kindly respond immediately to Mr. Fudge.
Oh, very well, said the Prime Minister weakly. Yes, I'll see Fudge.
He hurried back to his desk, straightening his tie as he went. He had barely resumed his seat and arranged his face into what he hoped was a relaxed and unfazed expression, when bright green flames burst into life in the empty grate beneath his marble mantelpiece. He watched, trying not to betray a flicker of surprise or alarm, as a portly man appeared within the flames, spinning as fast as a top. Seconds later, he had climbed out onto a rather fine antique rug, brushing ash from the sleeves of his long pin-striped cloak, a lime-green bowler hat in his hand.
"Ah, Prime Minister," said Cornelius Fudge, striding forwards with his hand outstretched. "Good to see you again."
The Prime Minister could not honestly return this compliment, so said nothing at all. He was not remotely pleased to see Fudge, whose occasional appearances, apart from being downright alarming in themselves, generally meant that he was about to hear some very bad news. Furthermore, Fudge was looking distinctly careworn. He was thinner, balder, and greyer, and his face had a crumpled look. The Prime Minister had seen that kind of look in politicians before, and it never boded well.
"How can I help you?" he said, shaking Fudge's hand very briefly and gesturing towards the hardest of the chairs in front of the desk.
"Difficult to know where to begin," muttered Fudge, pulling up the chair, sitting down, and placing his green bowler upon his knees. "What a week! What a week!"
"Had a bad one too, have you?" asked the Prime Minister stiffly, hoping to convey by this that he had quite enough on his plate already without any extra helpings from Fudge.
"Yes, of course," said Fudge,
rubbing his eyes wearily and looking morosely at the Prime Minister.
"I've been having the same week you have, Prime Minister. The Brockdale Bridge, the Bones and Vance murders, not to mention the ruckus in the West Country."
Some of your people were involved in those things, were they?"
Fudge fixed the Prime Minister with a rather stern look.
"Of course they were," he said. "Surely you've realised what's going on?"
"I..."
hesitated the Prime Minister. It was precisely this sort of behaviour that made him dislike Fudge's visit so much. He was, after all, the Prime Minister, and did not appreciate being made to feel like an ignorant schoolboy. But, of course, it had been like this from his very first meeting with Fudge on his very first evening as Prime Minister. He remembered it as though it were yesterday, and knew it would haunt him until his dying day. He had been standing alone in this very office, savouring the triumph that was his after so many years of dreaming and scheming, when he had heard a cough behind him, just like tonight, and turned to find that ugly little portrait talking to him, announcing that the Minister for Magic was about to arrive and introduce himself. Naturally, he had thought that the long campaign and the strain of the election had caused him to go mad. He had been utterly terrified to find a portrait talking to him, though this had been nothing to how he had felt when a self-proclaimed wizard had bounced out of the fireplace and shaken his hand. He had remained speechless throughout Fudge's kindly explanation that there were witches and wizards still living in secret all over the world, and his reassurances that he was not to bother his head about them, as the Ministry of Magic took responsibility for the whole wizarding community and prevented the non-magical population from getting wind of them. It was, said Fudge, a difficult job that encompassed everything from regulations on responsible use of broomsticks to keeping the dragon population under control. The Prime Minister remembered clutching the desk for support at this point. Fudge had then patted the shoulder of the still dumbstruck Prime Minister in a fatherly sort of way.
"Not to worry," he had said. "It's odds on you'll never see me again. I'll only bother you if there's something really serious going on our end, something that's likely to affect the Muggles, the non-magical population, I should say. Otherwise, it's live and let live, and I must say you're taking it a lot better than your predecessor. He tried to throw me out of the window, thought I was a hoax planned by the opposition."
At this, the Prime Minister had found his voice at last.
You're not a hoax, then?
It had been his last desperate hope.
No, said Fudge gently. No, I'm afraid I'm not. Look.
And he had turned the Prime Minister's teacup into a gerbil.
But,
said the Prime Minister breathlessly, watching his teacup chewing on the corner of his next speech,
but why has nobody told me?
The Minister for Magic only reveals him or herself to the Muggle Prime Minister of the day, said Fudge, poking his wand back inside his jacket. We find it the best way to maintain secrecy.
But then, bleated the Prime Minister, why hasn't a former Prime Minister warned me?
At this, Fudge had actually laughed.
My dear Prime Minister, are you ever going to tell anybody?
Still chortling, Fudge had thrown some powder into the fireplace, stepped into the emerald flames, and vanished with a whooshing sound. The Prime Minister had stood there quite motionless, and realized that he would never, as long as he lived, dare mention this encounter to a living soul, for who in the wide world would believe him? The shock had taken a little while to wear off. For a time he had tried to convince himself that Fudge had indeed been a hallucination brought on by lack of sleep during his gruelling election campaign. In a vain attempt to rid himself of all reminders of this uncomfortable encounter, he had given the gerbil to his delighted niece and instructed his private secretary to take down the portrait of the ugly little man who had announced Fudge's arrival. To the Prime Minister's dismay, however, the portrait had proved impossible to remove. When several carpenters, a builder or two, an art historian, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer had all tried unsuccessfully to prise it from the wall, the Prime Minister had abandoned the attempt and simply resolved to hope that the thing remained motionless and silent for the rest of his term in office. Occasionally he could have sworn he saw out of the corner of his eye the occupant of the painting yawning, or else scratching his nose, even, once or twice, simply walking out of his frame and leaving nothing but a stretch of muddy brown canvas behind. However, he had trained himself not to look at the picture very much, and always to tell himself firmly that his eyes were playing tricks on him when anything like this happened. Then, 3 years ago, on a night very like tonight, the Prime Minister had been alone in his office when the portrait had once again announced the imminent arrival of Fudge, who had burst out of the fireplace, sopping wet and in a state of considerable panic. Before the Prime Minister could ask why he was dripping all over the Axminster, Fudge had started ranting about a prison the Prime Minister had never heard of, a man named Sirius Black, something that sounded like Hogwarts, and a boy called Harry Potter, none of which made the remotest sense to the Prime Minister.
"I've just come from Azkaban," Fudge had panted, tipping a large amount of water out of the rim of his bowler hat into his pocket. "Middle of the North Sea, you know. Nasty flight. The Dementors are in uproar." He shuddered. "They've never had a breakout before. Anyway, I had to come to you, Prime Minister. Black's a known muggle killer, and may be planning to rejoin you-know-who. But, of course, you don't even know who you-know-who is."
He had gazed hopelessly at the Prime Minister for a moment, then said,
"Well, sit down, sit down. I'd better fill you in. Have a whiskey."
The Prime Minister had rather resented being told to sit down in his own office, let alone offered his own whiskey, but he sat nevertheless. Fudge had pulled out his wand, conjured two large glasses full of amber liquid out of thin air, pushed one of them into the Prime Minister's hand, and drawn up a chair. Fudge had talked for over an hour. At one point he had refused to say a certain name aloud, and wrote it instead on a piece of parchment which he had thrust into the Prime Minister's whisky-free hand. When at last Fudge had stood up to leave, the Prime Minister had stood up too.
"So you think that,
he had squinted down at the name in his left hand.
"Lord Vol—"
"He who must not be named," snarled Fudge.
"I'm sorry. You think that he who must not be named is still alive, then?" "Well, Dumbledore says he is," said Fudge, as he had fastened his pinstriped cloak under his chin. "But we've never found him. If you ask me, he's not dangerous unless he's got support. So it's Black we ought to be worrying about. You'll put out that warning, then? Excellent. Well, I hope we don't see each other again, Prime Minister. Good night."
But they had seen each other again. Less than a year later, a harassed-looking Fudge had appeared out of thin air in the Cabinet Room to inform the Prime Minister that there had been a spot of bother at the Quidditch, or that was what it had sounded like, World Cup, and that several muggles had been involved, but that the Prime Minister was not to worry. The fact that you-know-whose mark had been seen again meant nothing. Fudge was sure it was an isolated incident, and the Muggle Liaison Office was dealing with all memory modifications as they spoke.
"Oh, and I almost forgot," Fudge had added. "We're importing 3 foreign dragons and a sphinx for the Triwizard Tournament. Quite routine, but the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures tells me that it's down in the rulebook that we have to notify you if we're bringing highly dangerous creatures into the country."
Dragons? Spluttered the Prime Minister.
"Yes, 3, said Fudge, "and a sphinx. Well, good day to you."
The Prime Minister had hoped beyond hope that dragons and sphinxes would be the worst of it. But no. Less than 2 years later, Fudge had erupted out of the fire yet again, this time with the news that there had been a mass breakout from Azkaban.
"A mass breakout?" the Prime Minister had repeated hoarsely. "No need to worry, no need to worry," Fudge had shouted, already with one foot in the flames. "We'll have them rounded up in no time. Just thought you ought to know."
And before the Prime Minister had been able to shout,
"Now wait just one moment,"
Fudge had vanished in a shower of green sparks. Whatever the press and the opposition might say, the Prime Minister was not a foolish man. It had not escaped his notice that despite Fudge's assurances at their first meeting, they were now seeing rather a lot of each other, nor that Fudge was becoming more flustered with each visit. Little though he liked to think about the Minister for Magic, or, as he always called Fudge in his head, the other minister, the Prime Minister could not help but fear that the next time Fudge appeared, it would be with graver news still. The sight, therefore, of Fudge stepping out of the fire once more, looking dishevelled and fretful, and sternly surprised that the Prime Minister did not know exactly why he was there, was about the worst thing that had happened in the course of this extremely gloomy week.
"How should I know what's going on in the wizarding community?"
snapped the Prime Minister now.
"I have a country to run, and quite enough concerns at the moment without—"
"We have the same concerns,"
Fudge interrupted.
"The Brockdale Bridge didn't wear out. There wasn't really a hurricane. Those murders were not the work of Muggles. And Herbert Chorley's family would be safer without him. We are currently making arrangements to have him transferred to St. Mungo's Hospital for magical maladies and injuries. The move should be effected tonight."
"What do you... I'm afraid I..." "What?"
blustered the Prime Minister. Fudge took a great deep breath and said,
"Prime Minister, I'm very sorry to have to tell you that he's back. He who must not be named is back."
"Back? When you say back, he's alive? I mean..."
The Prime Minister groped in his memory for the details of that horrible conversation of 3 years previously, when Fudge had told him about the wizard who was feared above all others, the wizard who had committed 1,000 terrible crimes before his mysterious disappearance 15 years earlier.
"Yes, alive," said Fudge. "That is, I don't know. Is a man alive if he can't be killed? I don't really understand it, and Dumbledore won't explain properly. But anyway, he's certainly got a body, and is walking and talking and killing, so I suppose for the purposes of our discussion, yes, he's alive."
The Prime Minister did not know what to say to this, but a persistent habit of wishing to appear well-informed on any subject that came up made him cast around for any details he could remember of their previous conversations.
"Is Sirius Black with he who must not be named?"
"Black? Black?" said Fudge distractedly, turning his bowler rapidly in his fingers.
"Sirius Black, you mean? Merlin's beard, no! Black's dead. Turns out we were mistaken about Black. He was innocent, after all. And he wasn't in league with he who must not be named, either. I mean," he added defensively, spinning the bowler hat still faster, "all the evidence pointed. We had more than 50 eyewitnesses. But anyway, as I say, he's dead. Murdered, as a matter of fact. On Ministry of Magic premises. There's going to be an inquiry, actually."
To his great surprise, the Prime Minister felt a fleeting stab of pity for Fudge at this point. It was, however, eclipsed almost immediately by a glow of smugness at the thought that, deficient though he himself might be in the area of materialising out of fireplaces, there had never been a murder in any of the government departments under his charge. Not yet, anyway. While the Prime Minister surreptitiously touched the wood of his desk, Fudge continued,
"But Black's by the by now. The point is, we're at war, Prime Minister, and steps must be taken."
"At war?" repeated the Prime Minister nervously.
"Surely that's a little bit of an overstatement.
He who must not be named has now been joined by those of his followers who broke out of Azkaban in January,"
said Fudge, speaking more and more rapidly, and twirling his bowler so fast that it was a lime-green blur.
"Since they have moved into the open, they've been wreaking havoc. The Brockdale Bridge, he did it, Prime Minister. He threatened a mass muggle killing unless I stood aside for him, and good grief! So it's your fault those people were killed, and I'm having to answer questions about rusted rigging and corroded expansion joints, and I don't know what else,"
said the Prime Minister furiously.
"My fault?" said Fudge, colouring up. "Are you saying you would have caved in to blackmail like that?"
"Maybe not," said the Prime Minister, standing up and striding about the room, "but I would have put all my efforts into catching the blackmailer before he committed any such atrocity."
"Do you really think I wasn't already making every effort?" demanded Fudge heatedly. "Every aura in the Ministry was, and is, trying to find him and round up his followers, but we happen to be talking about one of the most powerful wizards of all time, a wizard who has eluded capture for almost 3 decades.
"So I suppose you're going to tell me he caused the hurricane in the West Country, too," said the Prime Minister, his temper rising with every pace he took. It was infuriating to discover the reason for all these terrible disasters and not to be able to tell the public. Almost worse than it being the government's fault after all.
"That was no hurricane," said Fudge miserably.
"Excuse me," barked the Prime Minister, now positively stamping up and down. "Trees uprooted, roofs ripped off, lampposts bent, horrible injuries."
"It was the Death Eaters," said Fudge.
"He who must not be named's followers. And we suspect giant involvement."
The Prime Minister stopped in his tracks as though he had hit an invisible wall.
"What involvement?"
Fudge grimaced.
"He used giants last time when he wanted to go for the grand effect. The Office of Misinformation has been working round the clock. We've had teams of obliviators out, trying to modify the memories of all the muggles who saw what really happened. We've got most of the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures running around Somerset, but we can't find the giant. It's been a disaster."
"You don't say," said the Prime Minister furiously.
"I won't deny that morale is pretty low at the Ministry," said Fudge. "What with all that, and then losing Amelia Bones."
"Losing who?"
"Amelia Bones, head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement. We think he who must not be named may have murdered her in person, because she was a very gifted witch, and all the evidence was that she put up a real fight."
Fudge cleared his throat, and, with an effort it seemed, stopped spinning his bowler hat.
"But that murder was in the newspapers," said the Prime Minister, momentarily diverted from his anger. "Our newspapers! Amelia Bones! It just said she was a middle-aged woman who lived alone. It was a nasty killing, wasn't it? It's had rather a lot of publicity. The police are baffled, you see."
Fudge sighed.
"Well, of course they are. Killed in a room that was locked from the inside, wasn't she? We, on the other hand, know exactly who did it. Not that that gets us any further towards catching him. And then there was Emmeline Vance. Maybe you didn't hear about that one."
"Oh, yes, I did," said the Prime Minister.
"It happened just round the corner from here, as a matter of fact. The papers had a field day with it. Breakdown of law and order in the Prime Minister's backyard."
"And as if all that wasn't enough," said Fudge, barely listening to the Prime Minister,
"we've got dementors swarming all over the place, attacking people left, right and centre."
Once upon a happier time, this sentence would have been unintelligible to the Prime Minister, but he was wiser now.
"I thought dementors guard the prisoners in Azkaban," he said cautiously.
"They did," said Fudge wearily, "but not any more. They've deserted the prison and joined he who must not be named. I won't pretend that wasn't a blow."
"But," said the Prime Minister with a sense of dawning horror, "didn't you tell me they're the creatures that drain hope and happiness out of people?"
"That's right. And they're breeding. That's what's causing all this mist."
The Prime Minister sank weak-kneed into the nearest chair. The idea of invisible creatures swooping through the towns and countryside, spreading despair and hopelessness in his voters, made him feel quite faint.
"Now see here, Fudge. You've got to do something. It's your responsibility as Minister for Magic.
My dear Prime Minister, you can't honestly think I'm still Minister for Magic after all this. I was sacked 3 days ago. The whole wizarding community has been screaming for my resignation for a fortnight. I've never known them so united in my whole term of office, said Fudge, with a brave attempt at a smile.
The Prime Minister was momentarily lost for words.
Despite his indignation at the position into which he had been placed, he still rather felt for the shrunken-looking man sitting opposite him.
"I'm very sorry," he said finally. "If there's anything I can do?"
"It's very kind of you, Prime Minister, but there is nothing. I was sent here tonight to bring you up to date on recent events and to introduce you to my successor. I rather thought he'd be here by now, but of course he's very busy at the moment with so much going on."
Fudge looked round at the portrait of the ugly little man wearing the long, curly silver wig, who was digging in his ear with the point of a quill.
Catching Fudge's eye, the portrait said, "He'll be here in a moment. He's just finishing a letter to Dumbledore."
"I wish him luck,"
said Fudge, sounding bitter for the first time.
"I've been writing to Dumbledore twice a day for the past fortnight, but he won't budge. If he'd just been prepared to persuade the boy, I might still be... Well, maybe Scrimgeour will have more success."
Fudge subsided into what was clearly an aggrieved silence. But it was broken almost immediately by the portrait, which suddenly spoke in its crisp, official voice.
"To the Prime Minister of Muggles, requesting a meeting. Urgent. Kindly respond immediately. Rufus Scrimgeour, Minister for Magic."
"Yes, yes, fine," said the Prime Minister distractedly, and he barely flinched as the flames in the grate turned emerald green again, rose up, and revealed a second spinning wizard in their heart, disgorging him moments later onto the antique rug.
Fudge got to his feet, and after a moment's hesitation, the Prime Minister did the same, watching the new arrival straighten up, dust down his long black robes, and look around. The Prime Minister's first foolish thought was that Rufus Scrimgeour looked rather like an old lion. There were streaks of grey in his mane of tawny hair and his bushy eyebrows. He had keen, yellowish eyes behind a pair of wire-rimmed spectacles, and a certain rangy, loping grace, even though he walked with a slight limp. There was an immediate impression of shrewdness and toughness. The Prime Minister thought he understood why the wizarding community preferred Scrimgeour to Fudge as a leader in these dangerous times.
"How do you do?" said the Prime Minister politely, holding out his hand.
Scrimgeour grasped it briefly, his eyes scanning the room, then pulled out a wand from under his robes.
"Fudge told you everything?"
he asked, striding over to the door and tapping the keyhole with his wand. The Prime Minister heard the lock click.
Yes, said the Prime Minister, and if you don't mind, I'd rather that door remained unlocked.
I'd rather not be interrupted, said Scrimgeour shortly, or watched, he added, pointing his wand at the windows so that the curtains swept across them. Right, well, I'm a busy man, so let's get down to business. First of all, we need to discuss your security.
The Prime Minister drew himself up to his fullest height and replied,
"I am perfectly happy with the security I've already got, thank you very—"
"Well, we're not," Scrimgeour cut in.
"It'll be a poor lookout for the Muggles if their Prime Minister gets put under the Imperious curse. The new secretary in your outer office—"
"I'm not getting rid of Kingsley Shacklebolt, if that's what you're suggesting," said the Prime Minister hotly. "He's highly efficient, gets through twice the work the rest of them—"
"That's because he's a wizard," said Scrimgeour, without a flicker of a smile. "A highly trained order, who has been assigned to you for your protection."
"Now, wait a moment,"
declared the Prime Minister. You can't just put your people into my office. I decide who works for me.
I thought you were happy with Shacklebolt, said Scrimgeour coldly.
I am, that's to say, I was.
Then there's no problem, is there? Said Scrimgeour.
Well, as long as Shacklebolt's work continues to be excellent, said the Prime Minister lamely, but Scrimgeour barely seemed to hear him.
Now, about Herbert Chorley, your junior minister, he continued, the one who has been entertaining the public by impersonating a duck.
What about him? Asked the Prime Minister.
He has clearly reacted to a poorly performed imperious curse, said Scrimgeour. It's addled his brains, but he could still be dangerous.
He's only quacking, said the Prime Minister weakly. Surely a bit of a rest, maybe go easy on the drink.
A team of healers from St. Mungo's Hospital for Magical Maladies and Injuries is examining him as we speak. So far he has attempted to strangle three of them, said Scrimgeour. I think it best that we remove him from Muggle society for a while.
Well, he'll be all right, won't he? Said the Prime Minister anxiously. Scrimgeour merely shrugged, already moving back towards the fireplace.
Well, that's really all I had to say. I will keep you posted of developments, Prime Minister, or at least I shall probably be too busy to come personally, in which case I shall send Fudge here. He has consented to stay on in an advisory capacity.
Fudge attempted to smile, but was unsuccessful. He merely looked as though he had toothache. Scrimgeour was already rummaging in his pocket for the mysterious powder that turned the fire green. The Prime Minister gazed hopelessly at the pair of them for a moment. Then the words he had fought to suppress all evening burst from him at last.
"But for heaven's sake, you're wizards! You can do magic! Surely you can sort out, well, anything!"
Scrimgeour turned slowly on the spot and exchanged an incredulous look with Fudge, who really did manage a smile this time, as he said kindly,
"The trouble is, the other side can do magic too, Prime Minister."
And with that the two wizards stepped one after the other into the bright green fire and vanished. Chapter 2. Spinner's End. Many miles away, the chilly mist that had pressed against the Prime Minister's windows drifted over a dirty river that wound between overgrown, rubbish-strewn banks. An immense chimney, relic of a disused mill, reared up, shadowy and ominous. There was no sound, apart from the whisper of the black water, and no sign of life, apart from a scrawny fox that had slunk down the bank to nose hopefully at some old fish-and-chip wrappings in the tall grass. But then, with a very faint pop, a slim, hooded figure appeared out of thin air on the edge of the river. The fox froze, wary eyes fixed upon this strange new phenomenon. The figure seemed to take its bearings for a few moments, then set off with light, quick strides, its long cloak rustling over the grass. With a second and louder pop, another hooded figure materialized.
"Wait!"
The harsh cry startled the fox, now crouching almost flat in the undergrowth. It leapt from its hiding place and up the bank. There was a flash of green light, a yelp, and the fox fell back to the ground, dead. The second figure turned over the animal with its toe.
"Just a fox," said a woman's voice dismissively from under the hood. "I thought perhaps an aura." "Sissy, wait!"
but her quarry, who had paused and looked back at the flash of light, was already scrambling up the bank the fox had just fallen down.
"Sissy, Narcissa, listen to me!"
The second woman caught the first and seized her arm, but the other wrenched it away.
"Go back, Bella! You must listen to me! I've listened already! I've made my decision! Leave me alone!"
The woman called Narcissa gained the top of the bank, where a line of old railings separated the river from a narrow, cobbled street. The other woman, Bella, followed at once. Side by side, they stood looking across the road at the rows and rows of dilapidated brick houses, their windows dull and blind in the darkness.
"He lives here?"
asked Bella in a voice of contempt.
"Here? In this muggle dunghill? We must be the first of our kind ever to set foot—"
But Narcissa was not listening. She had slipped through a gap in the rusty railings and was already hurrying across the road.
"Sissy, wait!"
Bella followed, her cloak streaming behind, and saw Narcissa darting through an alley between the houses into a second, almost identical street. Some of the street lamps were broken. The two women were running between patches of light and deep darkness. The pursuer caught up with her prey just as she turned another corner, this time succeeding in catching hold of her arm and swinging her round so that they faced each other.
"Sissy, you must not do this. You can't trust him."
"The Dark Lord trusts him, doesn't he?"
"The Dark Lord is, I believe, mistaken,"
Bella panted, and her eyes gleamed momentarily under her hood as she looked around to check that they were indeed alone.
"In any case, we were told not to speak of the plan to anyone. This is a betrayal of the Dark Lord's—"
"Let go, Bella!"
snarled Narcissa, and she drew a wand from beneath her cloak, holding it threateningly in the other's face. Bella merely laughed.
"Sissy! Your own sister? You wouldn't!"
"There is nothing I wouldn't do any more,"
Narcissa breathed, a note of hysteria in her voice. And as she brought down the wand like a knife, there was another flash of light. Bella let go of her sister's arm as though burned.
"Narcissa!"
But Narcissa had rushed ahead. Rubbing her hand, her pursuer followed again, keeping her distance now, as they moved deeper into the deserted labyrinth of brick houses. At last Narcissa hurried up a street called Spinner's End, over which the towering mill chimney seemed to hover like a giant admonitory finger. Her footsteps echoed on the cobbles as she passed boarded and broken windows until she reached the very last house, where a dim light glimmered through the curtains in a downstairs room. She had knocked on the door before Bella, cursing under her breath, had caught up. Together they stood waiting, panting slightly, breathing in the smell of the dirty river that was carried to them on the night breeze. After a few seconds, they heard movement behind the door, and it opened a crack. A sliver of a man could be seen looking out at them, a man with long black hair parted in curtains around a sallow face and black eyes. Narcissa threw back her hood. She was so pale that she seemed to shine in the darkness. The long blonde hair streaming down her back gave her the look of a drowned person.
"Narcissa," said the man, opening the door a little wider, so that the light fell upon her and her sister too. "What a pleasant surprise."
"Severus,"
she said in a strained whisper,
"may I speak to you? It's urgent."
"But of course."
He stood back to allow her to pass him into the house.
Her still-hooded sister followed without invitation.
"Snape,"
she said curtly as she passed him. "Bellatrix," he replied, his thin mouth curling into a slightly mocking smile as he closed the door with a snap behind them. They had stepped directly into a tiny sitting room, which had the feeling of a dark, padded cell. The walls were completely covered in books, most of them bound in old black or brown leather. A threadbare sofa, an old armchair, and a rickety table stood grouped together in a pool of dim light cast by a candle-filled lamp hung from the ceiling. The place had an air of neglect, as though it were not usually inhabited. Snape gestured Narcissa to the sofa. She threw off her cloak, cast it aside, and sat down, staring at her white and trembling hands clasped in her lap. Bellatrix lowered her hood more slowly. Dark as her sister was fair, with heavily lidded eyes and a strong jaw, she did not take her gaze from Snape as she moved to stand behind Narcissa. "So, what can I do for you?" Snape asked, settling himself in the armchair opposite the two sisters.
"We are alone, aren't we?"
Narcissa asked quietly.
"Yes, of course. Well, Wormtail's here, but we're not counting vermin, are we?"
He pointed his wand at the wall of books behind him, and, with a bang, a hidden door flew open, revealing a narrow staircase upon which a small man stood frozen.
"As you have clearly realized, Wormtail, we have guests," said Snape lazily.
The man crept hunchbacked down the last few steps and moved into the room. He had small, watery eyes, a pointed nose, and wore an unpleasant simper. His left hand was caressing his right, which looked as though it were encased in a bright silver glove.
"Narcissa,"
he said in a squeaky voice,
"and Bellatrix, how charming!"
"Wormtail will get us drinks if you'd like them," said Snape, "and then he will return to his bedroom."
Wormtail winced as though Snape had thrown something at him.
"I am not your servant,"
he squeaked, avoiding Snape's eye.
"Really? I was under the impression that the Dark Lord placed you here to assist me."
"To assist, yes, but not to make you drinks and clean your house."
"I had no idea, Wormtail, that you were craving more dangerous assignments," said Snape silkily. "This can be easily arranged. I shall speak to the Dark Lord."
"I can speak to him myself if I want to."
"Of course you can," said Snape, sneering. "But in the meantime, bring us drinks. Some of the elf-made wine will do."
Wormtail hesitated for a moment, looking as though he might argue, but then turned and headed through a second hidden door. They heard banging and a clinking of glasses. Within seconds he was back, bearing a dusty bottle and three glasses upon a tray. He dropped these on the rickety table and scurried from their presence, slamming the book-covered door behind him. Snape poured out three glasses of blood-red wine and handed two of them to the sisters. Narcissa murmured a word of thanks, whilst Bellatrix said nothing but continued to glower at Snape. This did not seem to discompose him. On the contrary, he looked rather amused.
"The Dark Lord," he said, raising his glass and draining it.
The sisters copied him. Snape refilled their glasses. As Narcissa took her second drink, she said in a rush,
"Severus, I'm sorry to come here like this, but I had to see you. I think you are the only one who can help me."
Snape held up a hand to stop her, then pointed his wand again at the concealed staircase door. There was a loud bang and a squeal, followed by the sound of Wormtail scurrying back up the stairs. "My apologies," said Snape. "He has lately taken to listening at doors. I don't know what he means by it. You were saying, Narcissa." She took a great, shuddering breath and started again.
"Severus, I know I ought not to be here. I've been told to say nothing to anyone, but..."
"Then you ought to hold your tongue,"
snarled Bellatrix,
"particularly in present company."
"Present company?" repeated Snape sardonically. "And what am I to understand by that, Bellatrix?"
"That I don't trust you, Snape, as you very well know."
Narcissa let out a noise that might have been a dry sob and covered her face with her hands. Snape set his glass down upon the table and sat back again, his hands upon the arms of his chair, smiling into Bellatrix's glowering face. "Narcissa, I think we ought to hear what Bellatrix is bursting to say. It will save tedious interruptions." "Well, continue, Bellatrix," said Snape. "Why is it that you do not trust me?"
100 reasons!"
she said loudly, striding out from behind the sofa to slam her glass upon the table.
"Where to start? Where were you when the Dark Lord fell? Why did you never make any attempt to find him when he vanished? What have you been doing all these years that you've lived in Dumbledore's pocket? Why did you stop the Dark Lord procuring the Philosopher's Stone? Why did you not return at once when the Dark Lord was reborn? Where were you a few weeks ago when we battled to retrieve the prophecy for the Dark Lord? And why, Snape, is Harry Potter still alive when you have had him at your mercy for 5 years?"
She paused, her chest rising and falling rapidly, the colour high in her cheeks. Behind her, Narcissa sat motionless, her face still hidden in her hands. Snape smiled. "Before I answer you..." "Oh, yes, Bellatrix, I am going to answer. You can carry my words back to the others who whisper behind my back and carry false tales of my treachery to the Dark Lord. Before I answer you, I say, let me ask a question in turn. Do you really think that the Dark Lord has not asked me each and every one of those questions? And do you really think that had I not been able to give satisfactory answers, I would be sitting here talking to you?" She hesitated.
"I know he believes you, but..."
"You think he is mistaken? Or that I have somehow hoodwinked him? Fooled the Dark Lord, the greatest wizard, the most accomplished legilimens the world has ever seen?" Bellatrix said nothing, but looked, for the first time, a little discomfited. Snape did not press the point. He picked up his drink again, sipped it, and continued. "You ask where I was when the Dark Lord fell. I was where he had ordered me to be, at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, because he wished me to spy upon Albus Dumbledore. You know, I presume, that it was on the Dark Lord's orders that I took up the post." She nodded almost imperceptibly, and then opened her mouth, but Snape forestalled her. "You ask why I did not attempt to find him when he vanished. For the same reason that Avery, Yaxley, the Carrows, Greyback, Lucius..." He inclined his head slightly to Narcissa. "And many others did not attempt to find him. I believed him finished. I'm not proud of it. I was wrong. But there it is. If he had not forgiven we who lost faith at that time, he would have very few followers left."
"He'd have me," said Bellatrix passionately. "I, who spent many years in Azkaban for him."
"Yes, indeed. Most admirable," said Snape in a bored voice. Of course, you weren't a lot of use to him in prison, but the gesture was undoubtedly fine.
Gesture!
She shrieked. In her fury, she looked slightly mad.
While I endured the Dementors, you remained at Hogwarts, comfortably playing Dumbledore's pet.
Not quite, said Snape calmly. He wouldn't give me the Defence Against the Dark Arts job, you know. Seemed to think it might bring about a relapse, tempt me into my old ways.
This was your sacrifice for the Dark Lord, not to teach your favourite subject,
she jeered.
Why did you stay there all that time, Snape, still spying on Dumbledore for a master you believed dead?
Hardly, said Snape, although the Dark Lord is pleased that I never deserted my post. I had 16 years of information on Dumbledore to give him when he returned, a rather more useful welcome-back present than endless reminiscences of how unpleasant Azkaban is.
But you stayed!
Yes, Bellatrix, I stayed, said Snape, betraying a hint of impatience for the first time. I had a comfortable job that I preferred to a stint in Azkaban. They were rounding up the Death Eaters, you know. Dumbledore's protection kept me out of jail. It was most convenient, and I used it. I repeat, the Dark Lord does not complain that I stayed, so I do not see why you do. I think you next wanted to know, he pressed on a little more loudly, for Bellatrix showed every sign of interrupting, why I stood between the Dark Lord and the Philosopher's Stone. That is easily answered. He did not know whether he could trust me. He thought, like you, that I had turned from faithful Death Eater to Dumbledore's stooge. He was in a pitiable condition, very weak, sharing the body of a mediocre wizard. He did not dare reveal himself to a former ally, if that ally might turn him over to Dumbledore or the Ministry. I deeply regret that he did not trust me. He would have returned to power 3 years sooner. As it was, I saw only greedy and unworthy Quirrell attempting to steal the stone, and, I admit, I did all I could to thwart him. Bellatrix's mouth twisted as though she had taken an unpleasant dose of medicine.
But you didn't return when he came back. You didn't fly back to him at once when you felt the dark mark burn.
Correct. I returned 2 hours later. I returned on Dumbledore's orders.
On Dumbledore's?
She began in tones of outrage.
Think,
said Snape, impatient again. Think! By waiting 2 hours, just 2 hours, I ensure that I could remain at Hogwarts as a spy. By allowing Dumbledore to think that I was only returning to the Dark Lord's side because I was ordered to, I have been able to pass information on Dumbledore and the Order of the Phoenix ever since. Consider, Bellatrix. The dark mark had been growing stronger for months. I knew he must be about to return. All the Death Eaters knew. I had plenty of time to think about what I wanted to do, to plan my next move, to escape like Karkaroff, didn't I? The Dark Lord's initial displeasure at my lateness vanished entirely, I assure you, when I explained that I remained faithful. Although Dumbledore thought I was his man. Yes, the Dark Lord thought that I had left him for ever, but he was wrong.
But what use have you been? Sneered Bellatrix. What useful information have we had from you?
My information has been conveyed directly to the Dark Lord, said Snape. If he chooses not to share it with you...
He shares everything with me,
said Bellatrix, firing up at once.
He calls me his most loyal, his most faithful.
Does he? Said Snape, his voice delicately inflected to suggest his disbelief. Does he still? after the fiasco with the ministry?
That was not my fault,
said Bellatrix, flushing.
The Dark Lord has in the past entrusted me with his most precious. If Lucius hadn't...
Don't you dare, don't you dare blame my husband,
said Narcissa in a low and deadly voice, looking up at her sister. There is no point apportioning blame, said Snape smoothly. What is done is done.
But not by you,
said Bellatrix furiously.
No, you were once again absent while the rest of us ran dangers, were you not, Snape?
My orders were to remain behind, said Snape. Perhaps you disagree with the Dark Lord. Perhaps you think that Dumbledore would not have noticed if I had joined forces with the Death Eaters to fight the Order of the Phoenix. And, forgive me, you speak of dangers. You were facing 6 teenagers, were you not?
They were joined, as you very well know, by half of the Order before long,
snarled Bellatrix.
And while we are on the subject of the Order, you still claim you cannot reveal the whereabouts of their headquarters, don't you?
I am not the secret keeper. I cannot speak the name of the place. You understand how the enchantment works, I think. The Dark Lord is satisfied with the information I have passed him on the Order. It led, as perhaps you have guessed, to the recent capture and murder of Emmeline Vance, and it certainly helped dispose of Sirius Black, though I give you full credit for finishing him off. He inclined his head and toasted her. Her expression did not soften.
You are avoiding my last question, Snape. Harry Potter. You could have killed him at any point in the past 5 years. You have not done it. Why?
Have you discussed this matter with the Dark Lord? Asked Snape.
I am asking you, Snape.
If I had murdered Harry Potter, the Dark Lord could not have used his blood to regenerate, making him invincible.
You claim you foresaw his use of the boy,
she jeered. I do not claim it. I had no idea of his plans. I have already confessed that I thought the Dark Lord dead. I am merely trying to explain why the Dark Lord is not sorry that Potter survived, at least until a year ago.
But why did you keep him alive?
Have you not understood me? It was only Dumbledore's protection that was keeping me out of Azkaban. Do you disagree that murdering his favourite student might have turned him against me? But there was more to it than that. I should remind you that when Potter first arrived at Hogwarts, there were still many stories circulating about him, rumours that he himself was a great dark wizard, which was how he had survived the Dark Lord's attack. Indeed, many of the Dark Lord's old followers thought Potter might be a standard around which we could all rally once more. I was curious, I admitted, and not at all inclined to murder him the moment he set foot in the castle. Of course, it became apparent to me very quickly that he had no extraordinary talent at all. He has fought his way out of a number of tight corners by a simple combination of sheer luck and more talented friends. He is mediocre to the last degree, though as obnoxious and self-satisfied as was his father before him. I have done my utmost to have him thrown out of Hogwarts, where I believe he scarcely belongs. But kill him, or allow him to be killed in front of me? I would have been a fool to risk it, with Dumbledore close at hand.
And through all this we are supposed to believe Dumbledore has never suspected you?
Asked Bellatrix.
He has no idea of your true allegiance. He trusts you implicitly still.
I have played my part well, said Snape.
And you overlook Dumbledore's greatest weakness.
He has to believe the best of people. I spun him a tale of deepest remorse when I joined his staff, fresh from my Death Eater days, and he embraced me with open arms, though, as I say, never allowing me nearer the dark arts than he could help. Dumbledore has been a great wizard. Oh, yes, he has, for Bellatrix had made a scathing noise. The Dark Lord acknowledges it. I am pleased to say, however, that Dumbledore is growing old. The duel with the Dark Lord last month shook him. He has since sustained a serious injury because his reactions are slower than they once were. But through all these years, he has never stopped trusting Severus Snape, and therein lies my great value to the Dark Lord. Bellatrix still looked unhappy, though she appeared unsure how best to attack Snape next. Taking advantage of her silence, Snape turned to her sister. "Now, you came to ask me for help, Narcissa?" Narcissa looked up at him, her face eloquent with despair.
"Yes, Severus. I think you are the only one who can help me. I have nowhere else to turn. Lucius is in jail, and..."
She closed her eyes, and two large tears seeped from beneath her eyelids.
"The Dark Lord has forbidden me to speak of it,"
Narcissa continued, her eyes still closed.
"He wishes none to know of the plan. It is very secret."
"But if he has forbidden it, you ought not to speak," said Snape at once. "The Dark Lord's word is law." Narcissa gasped, as though he had doused her with cold water. Bellatrix looked satisfied for the first time since she had entered the house.
"There," she said triumphantly to her sister, "even Snape says so. You are told not to talk, so hold your silence."
But Snape had got to his feet and strode to the small window, peered through the curtains at the deserted street, then closed them again with a jerk. He turned round to face Narcissa, frowning. "It so happens that I know of the plan," he said in a low voice. "I am one of the few the Dark Lord has told. Nevertheless, had I not been in on the secret, Narcissa, you would have been guilty of great treachery to the Dark Lord."
"I thought you must know about it,"
said Narcissa, breathing more freely.
"He trusts you so, Severus."
"You know about the plan?"
said Bellatrix, her fleeting expression of satisfaction replaced by a look of outrage.
"You know?"
"Certainly," said Snape. "But what help do you require, Narcissa? If you are imagining I can persuade the Dark Lord to change his mind, I'm afraid there is no hope, none at all."
"Severus,"
she whispered, tears sliding down her pale cheeks.
"My son, my only son."
"Draco should be proud," said Bellatrix indifferently. "The Dark Lord is granting him a great honour. And I will say this for Draco. He isn't shrinking away from his duty. He seems glad of a chance to prove himself, excited at the prospect."
Narcissa began to cry in earnest, gazing beseechingly all the while at Snape.
"That's because he's 16 and has no idea what lies in store. Why, Severus? Why, my son? It is too dangerous. This is vengeance for Lucius's mistake. I know it."
Snape said nothing. He looked away from the sight of her tears as though they were indecent, but he could not pretend not to hear her.
"That's why he's chosen Draco, isn't it?"
she persisted.
"To punish Lucius."
"If Draco succeeds," said Snape, still looking away from her, "he will be honoured above all others."
"But he won't succeed,"
sobbed Narcissa.
"How can he when the Dark Lord himself
Bellatrix gasped. Narcissa seemed to lose her nerve.
I only meant that nobody has yet succeeded. Severus, please, you have always been Draco's favourite teacher. You're Lucius's old friend. I beg you. You are the Dark Lord's favourite, his most trusted adviser. Will you speak to him? Persuade him?
The Dark Lord will not be persuaded, and I am not stupid enough to attempt it, said Snape flatly. I cannot pretend that the Dark Lord is not angry with Lucius. Lucius was supposed to be in charge. He got himself captured, along with how many others, and failed to retrieve the prophecy into the bargain. Yes, the Dark Lord is angry, Narcissa. Very angry indeed.
Then I am right. He has chosen Draco in revenge,
choked Narcissa.
He does not mean him to succeed. He wants him to be killed, trying.
When Snape said nothing, Narcissa seemed to lose what little self-restraint she still possessed. Standing up, she staggered to Snape and seized the front of his robes. Her face close to his, her tears falling onto his chest, she gasped,
"You could do it! You could do it instead of Draco Severus! You would succeed, of course you would, and he would reward you beyond all of us!"
Snape caught hold of her wrists and removed her clutching hands. Looking down into her tear-stained face, he said slowly, "He intends me to do it in the end, I think, but he is determined that Draco should try first. You see, in the unlikely event that Draco succeeds, I shall be able to remain at Hogwarts a little longer, fulfilling my useful role as spy."
"In other words, it doesn't matter to him if Draco is killed."
"The Dark Lord is very angry," repeated Snape quietly. "He failed to hear the prophecy. You know as well as I do, Narcissa, that he does not forgive easily." She crumpled, falling at his feet, sobbing and moaning on the floor.
"My only son! My only son!"
"You should be proud," said Bellatrix ruthlessly. "If I had sons, I would be glad to give them up to the service of the Dark Lord."
Narcissa gave a little scream of despair and clutched at her long, blonde hair. Snape stooped, seized her by the arms, lifted her up, and steered her back onto the sofa. He then poured her more wine and forced the glass into her hand. "Narcissa, that's enough. Drink this. Listen to me." She quietened a little. Slopping wine down herself, she took a shaky sip. "It might be possible for me to help Draco." She sat up, her face paper white, her eyes huge.
"Severus! Oh, Severus! You would help him! Would you look after him? See, he comes to no harm!"
"I can try." She flung away her glass. It skidded across the table as she slid off the sofa into a kneeling position at Snape's feet, seized his hand in both of hers, and pressed her lips to it.
"If you were there to protect him, Severus, will you swear it? Will you make the unbreakable vow?"
"The unbreakable vow?" Snape's expression was blank, unreadable. Bellatrix, however, let out a cackle of triumphant laughter.
"Aren't you listening, Narcissa? Oh, he'll try, I'm sure. The usual empty words, the usual slithering out of action. Oh, on the Dark Lord's orders, of course."
Snape did not look at Bellatrix. His black eyes were fixed upon Narcissa's tear-filled blue ones as she continued to clutch his hand. "Certainly, Narcissa, I shall make the unbreakable vow," he said quietly. "Perhaps your sister will consent to be our bonder." Bellatrix's mouth fell open. Snape lowered himself so that he was kneeling opposite Narcissa. Beneath Bellatrix's astonished gaze, they grasped right hands. "You will need your wand, Bellatrix," said Snape coldly. She drew it, still looking astonished. "And you will need to move a little closer," he said. She stepped forward so that she stood over them and placed the tip of her wand on their linked hands. Narcissa spoke.
"Will you, Severus, watch over my son Draco as he attempts to fulfill the Dark Lord's wishes?"
"I will," said Snape.
A thin tongue of brilliant flame issued from the wand and wound its way around their hands like a red-hot wire. "And will you, to the best of your ability, protect him from harm?"
"I will," said Snape.
A second tongue of flame shot from the wand and interlinked with the first, making a fine, glowing chain. "And should it prove necessary, if it seems Draco will fail,"
whispered Narcissa. Snape's hand twitched within hers, but he did not draw away.
"Will you carry out the deed that the Dark Lord has ordered Draco to perform?"
There was a moment's silence. Bellatrix watched, her wand upon their clasped hands, her eyes wide. "I will," said Snape. Bellatrix's astounded face glowed red in the blaze of a third tongue of flame, which shot from the wand, twisted with the others, and bound itself thickly around their clasped hands, like a rope. Like a fiery snake.